The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home, your world is limitless.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so, this week is Palliative Care Week, and Donal Lynch spoke to me about the incredible support and kindness shown to his wife Carmel and their entire family by the staff of the Palliative Care Unit in Tralee. Coverage of 13-year-old Braden Harrington overcoming his stutter with some help from Joe Biden made international headlines in recent weeks. Sandra Kelly and Professor Ivan Perry got in touch to tell me what living with a stammer is like for them and the challenges and cruelties they faced along the way. And V2 is the new thriller by best-selling author Robert Harris. The novel is set in World War II London during the aftermath of a V2 bombing, and he talked to me about the incredible history at the heart of the story. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy it. Donal Lynch. Good morning, Donal.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
It's really nice to talk to you. It's not often that somebody gets in touch to say, listen, I really just want to say thank you. And we'll get to that in a few minutes' time. But thanks for coming on with us this morning. How are you doing?
No, I'm not too bad. It's probably a strange place to be, but this is the way life is, and we have to take what's thrown in front of us.
That's for sure. Bring us back. Bring me back to a happy time in your life, Donal, when you met Carmel.
Yeah, Carmel was not living too far. We were both from the Stole.
Yeah.
We just clicked. It was. We were married 21 years this year. Mm-hmm. 21 very happy years. And I suppose Carmel was one of those people who was selfless. And that came true in the last number of months. But all through her life from the very start, she was the ideal homemaker. That compulsive worrier about David and myself's future. And she made the perfect life for us. And I'm so grateful in so many ways.
And what were you doing for a living?
I sell cars for a living in McGilligut's in Tralee.
And Carmel?
Carmel was a secondary school teacher. And she spent time in Carlow and parts of Cork and for finally settling in Abbeyfield.
And what did you like to do together? When did you have some crack?
We done the norm things very nicely. I think Carmel was one of those people, and I was. We liked our animals, that seaside walk, the odd sun holiday. We had our own little kingdom here with cats and dogs and horses, and they ruled the order of our day. And it was kind of that magical life in ways, you know. And we were like Dave and myself and Carmel. We were three peas in a pod. We led relatively private lives. And it's her loss is immense.
You
live that way.
Of course, I can, especially as you describe it. But as you say, in Listowel, you've got what, race week? Would you have been regulars?
Oh, we would have been. And Carmel's grandfather was a founding member of the committee.
Oh.
I know serving that committee. And she was very proud of where she came from. It was a great piece of pride with Riders Week you attend and the race meeting. And it is a very nice town to grow up in and live in. There's a great buzz about it.
I probably passed you by in the street once.
Probably did. We passed you in the arms one morning, I'm sure, one Saturday morning a few years ago.
Did you say hello?
Yeah, Carmel was bursting to say hello to you anyway, but you're probably busy at the time.
No, she should have said hello. What happened in March then, just gone by, when we were all starting to feel the world was caving in on us?
It was actually March 19.
Yeah.
And I suppose people have been, and Carmel sadly passed away in June of 20. I suppose I was prompted initially to contact your researchers because I've got so many nice letters and cards from various people. And this one from a customer of mine really struck a note when she quoted the poet Michael Faber, who lost his wife to cancer. And he said, "All I can do in what remains of my life is mention to whoever cares to listen that a woman once existed who was kind and beautiful and brave. And I will not forget how the world was altered beyond recognition when we met." And that struck a chord with me, just those words. And in Carmel, since March 19, her bravery and selfless approach to her illness was truly inspirational. And this is why I rang you, because today, tomorrow, and last week and next week, there are people coming out of various doctors' surgeries and consultants who are getting terrible news. But thankfully, to the advance of medicine, some will have a happy outcome. But for others like Carmel, I remember that day quite clearly when we were told she was diagnosed with a brain tumour in March, and within a few weeks we were told the dreadful news that you'll never drive again, you'll never teach again, and you have 12 to 15 months. And what really is amazing is how Carmel normalised her life. We've done the normal things so nicely. We still pass around the store doing things in that nice way. And I think the only way she was able to do it was that she was a person of immense faith, and she trusted in God's will. And we had great people around us, like the local parish priest, Father Declan. There was a man, Michael O'Connor, who had great devotion to Padre Pio, and Father Vincent of the Frari, who kept her motivated and kept her spirits alive in her quest for peace and her quest for a miracle. And that's what kept her going through all this badness and sadness, was this quest for a miracle. And if ever anybody asked Carmel and I, we were out about living our normal lives, she said, she'd smile gently and say, "I'll get my miracle." And it's hard to go through it.
I can't imagine, actually, but when you had that 12 to 18 months together and you were trying to get on with your lives as normal, what were you constantly thinking, the clock is ticking, or did you manage to live in the moment?
We lived in a probably bubble of denial.
Okay. Oh, yeah, well, yeah. Believe
and
that.
It's the only way you can, we could probably cope. But in fairness to Carmel, she was able to almost instruct me what to do as well, and she kept little projects. Like, for example, whenever we were going for treatment, we were never going for treatment. It was always to get something in a shop or collect something. We had the most wonderful Christmas last year that was 3 months in the making, because every time we went for somewhere for consultation or treatment, we were getting something for Christmas or getting something for somebody else. Mm. So it was normalised, and we went from one project to the next, and it kept us sane, really.
When did palliative care come into your lives?
Last August, in August 19, things were getting a little bit tough, and no treatment was working. Anything they tried, and they were an unbelievable team in Limerick. Dr. Carpenti, he had a great sense of humanity and empathy, mm-hmm. along with our GP, Dr. Dynan, who translated the information in a layman's terms to what was going on. And then we were referred to the team in Tralee under the guidance of Dr. Patricia Sheehan, who's an unbelievable person, really. And all I can say is she has the ability to put a team around her that are moulded exactly like herself. And one of the things that palliative, I suppose, initially strikes, it does, to be honest, it sends a shiver down your spine, really. There's a finality about it. There's a worry that this is the end. But I think the name they have in the centre inside and she is soothness, and it means care and support. And our initial thoughts were immediately wrong when we met them, because it was support. And they liaised with, I suppose initially with support for me as a husband and carer, to have this second backup along with the GP and the oncology ward, that you had these people calling to the house. They were very in tune with and aware of what was happening. I wasn't, or we weren't. We were still semi-unaware of the severity of how things could go. But I remember Geraldine would call in the most thoughtful way, and they'd go back and they'd chat to... She'd go back and chat to Dr. Sheehan, who would liaise with Dr. Carpenti and Dr. Dynan, and they would just come up with the best solution so that Carmel could live her life as normal as possible in the best way. And that's all she wanted.
And they endeavoured to normalise
unbelievable way.
Her room, the bed sheets, the
everything. It was just their job was to make life easy for Carmel. Mm. And then, you know, we kind of wallowed along and everything was fine. And, you know, sometimes Cam would say, there's no need for them to call. You know, she was trying to live a little bit in denial, but they were always there and aware. And I remember from February, March onwards, things started to get a bit tougher and pain was hard. And we went in on the 21st of May to have a consultation with Dr. Sheehan. And for someone like Carmel and myself, who were apprehensive, they took the worry out of it. We met five most amazing people that day, and they just laid the foundation for Carmel having the most unbelievable happy. And happy is a funny word to use when you're in such a sad place. But these people are just inspirational. The way it's set up, the culture in there. I remember talking to a Dr. Romer one day, and I said, Anne, who was head of nursing, I said, who interviews these people? And there's just an amazing support group, and the place itself. Like, I remember Tim, he was a healthcare assistant, and Jean Brown, the nurse, they were two nice people that evening, and there was a Kira physio, and along with Dr. Sheehan, and she said, you should come in, Carmel, and we'll get you back on track. And of course, it was pain relief she was in for. And Carmel, I suppose, she said, I'll leave you be, have a chat among yourselves. And the door was hardly closed. And Carmel said, I want to come in.
Yeah.
And we were showed this beautiful, like, this is like an apartment out in Lanzarote or somewhere. It was a non-suite room with patio furniture, patio doors on the garden, furniture and a beautiful garden. Mm. And they were so nice and positive. It was like someone taking you up to a hotel room. And the next morning, I remember Carmel said to me, I wouldn't mind if I had to come back here again.
Mm.
And that's the difference these people make to someone who has a bad prognosis.
Can I ask you when Carmel died, Donal?
She passed away on the 9th of June.
And were you beside her?
I was there with David, the three of us together. We went in, as I said, the 21st of May for pain relief.
Yeah.
The 31st of May, I remember the weather was very fine. I remember walking around the garden there in the morning and in the evening because it was very warm. And she said, I hope they won't give me a walking aid, you know, because things were getting tough. Mm. And the 1st of June, we were married 21 years, and she never woke. And I remember the next few days, it was evident from what they were telling me that this tumour had reactivated and they couldn't do anything about it. But she laughed, she cried, she talked, she joked with those nurses and the team in there. And it was like as if, genuinely, there was nobody else in the hospital bar Carmel. And there was no other family bar us. We got that feeling. She just said, all the time in the world, they were the most unbelievable bunch of people that made such a difference at such a difficult time.
And it sounds like they were so invested in Carmel, in her story, in your lives.
I'd never experienced anything in my life to compare.
Really?
Nothing.
Because you're describing, Donal, what has to be the most harrowing, difficult thing to happen to a person, to a father, husband, and yet you're describing it with a sort of an admiration and a sense of contentment almost.
Well, look, life is tough and the dark hours, but the consolation we got from the support that Dr. Sheehan and our team gave us is just unbelievable. And not just me and David, but my Carmel's sisters, Olive and Ona, and my own family, they just couldn't have done anymore. And I hate singling out anybody, but I remember there was a Bridget and Denise, they were on nights for 3 nights. And you can imagine someone, the example of this devotion to their vocation, coming in at some hour in the morning, so 3 or 4 o'clock, making Carmel comfortable, and going to her bag and taking out her own creams and rubbing them on her hands and face. And I remember that same nurse Bridget, in the last 2 days, she not only had her unbelievable nurse's hat on, but she took over the motherly role for David and put her under her wing in the most unbelievable way. I remember on the Tuesday the 9th, a very nice house after Dr. Melissa and Bridget called us out, and every time I was called out, David was called out, and they told us, look, she's getting weak, it'll be today or tomorrow. And Bridget just caught me by the arm and said, let yourself and Dave go in your own. Because, you know, there was relations and sisters and so on in the room. And we went in and we said, oh, bitch. And she picked that tie from just the three of us there together.
Yeah, she knew.
She knew. And Bridget, just if I told you what you did for David in that evening, do you know, kind of, it was just, you know, she could retire with an Oscar, do you know, kind of, for the performance she put on.
Yeah.
And that was just typical of the kindness. And that's why that card that the lovely lady sent me inspired me to ring your people, because these people made such a difference. Like, in January of 19, we were to have a special year. We were planning a year. We were both 50. We were married 20 years. And in March 19, our world changed. But we met the most special people from March 19 to June 20. That'll leave an everlasting memory in my mind, and I'm so grateful. And what I really want to do, really, and I'd want to be going on with, is that these people work tirelessly for the good of others, and yet they have to worry about fundraising. And I just say to anyone, in January, February of 19, we were living normal lives, and never would I have thought they were talking to Ryan Tuberty or talking about palliative care. But the difference they've made to our lives is unbelievable. And they can only prompt people in whatever way they can to support their local palliative care and hospice for the work they do for so many people. I was never asked ever what I did, or they never asked Carmel what she did. They just treated us. And they do. And what I hear is that they're the same to everybody.
How have you been, Donald? How are you getting on?
It's a tough place to be.
Of course it is.
You know, we had a nice life.
Yeah.
You know where you go home, and no matter how bad your day is, you have someone to talk to and confide in. And she's just not there anymore. And I'm glad, I'm lucky to have David, because he's a carbon copy of Carmel in so many ways. Do you know kind of way she's... We just have each other for support. And to be honest, we've been so lucky in ways, in that we have an unbelievable family. Carmel's sisters are Owen and Olive. My own family have been unbelievably helped. My own employers, even. Patrick and Destiny and McGillicutt gave FO to me the time off so I could spend time with Carmel and David. And that time, a cherished time that I'd never get back. And even COVID, there was positives. David was here for how many months with Carmel? There was no watch. We were just three people together living life the best we could. And that's what inspires me more than else about her, that I have to pull myself together. That she was setting flowers and all these things, and them same flowers that she set around the garden, they're up in her grave today. You know, so it's just...
I hear you. You never know the time or the place.
No,
and we make our plans
just,
and then unfortunately fate has other plans, doesn't it? And
you just have to have balance in your life and do the best you can.
As Moira has sent out a tweet to say, Donal and Carmel were pure listole, a gorgeous couple.
Thank you.
You know, and there's a lot of people relating to your story this morning. And a text says, if I may say something, please, I think that lovely lady Carmel got her miracle in a way, leaving this lovely man her strength and courage and love to carry on with their equally, I'm sure, strong son. It's a miracle. These medical staff are indeed wonderful people, and God bless them all. Donald, I hope I meet you sometime down in Listowel.
And we'll definitely meet up this time.
I'd like that.
That'd be great. And thanks for giving me the opportunity. And
no, please, thank you.
All I want to do is to erase any fears that people have or worries, because these people are just unbelievable support.
Listen, our very best to you and to David and your extended family. And thank you for remembering Carmel in such an eloquent and kind, loving way today, and to allow us to check ourselves on occasion to remember the people in palliative care in homes and hospices around the country who are maybe working in reception or cleaning the floors or nursing, whatever they might be doing. But kerryhospice.com, if people want to respond in some class of financial donation to your story today, even though I know that's not what you were on to say. But thank you for telling us your story, Donald. It's beautiful, it's sad, but I think it's necessary what you did today. So thank you.
Thanks very much, Ryan. I really appreciate it.
I'm wishing you every good wish and great love from us all here.
Okay, excellent. Thanks again.
You mind yourself. We'll see
all
you soon,
best.
I hope.
Thanks,
Ryan. Thank you,
see
Donald.
You.
Thank you so
Ryan,
much.
Thanks.
10 to 10 this Monday morning, and as Dolan says, a brave man and timely reminder of the heroic work done by our friends in the world and area of palliative care. And I hope they know how grateful we are to them this morning. One of the emails that really caught our eye in the last few days came from Sandra Kelly, and it is something that will probably stop you in your tracks for a lot of reasons. It will all become apparent when I say good morning to her. Good morning, Sandra. Nice to talk to you.
Hi, Ryan. Hi there. Good morning. How are you?
I'm really good. And I loved your email, Sandra, because it struck a chord for so many reasons. And I was thinking about the Joe Biden story we heard about a little bit earlier on. And I suppose before we get into the full details of your story, will you tell us who you are and where you're from and what you're up to?
Yeah, so I'm from Newbridge in County Kildare. I'm 37 and I work as a clerical officer with the THSE. And I'm challenged with a stutter.
And I think what I'd like to do is, so many people this last few weeks were going, God, we didn't get to the electric picnic this year. It was such a big event for us. The bands, the festival goers, they couldn't get there. But I was struck in your email, Sandra, by what happened to you there last year, and how it nearly, a year later, nearly added to the reason why you got in touch with us. What happened?
So last year at Electric Picnic, myself and my sister, we stopped and were asking for directions to the showers. And he responded with, "Are you looking for the showers?" And himself and his whole line burst out laughing into our faces.
How does that make you feel?
It actually made me feel so bad that I actually left on the second day. I just couldn't stay there. That's how much it affected me and humiliated me. It was absolutely dreadful.
If you go through a drive-through to order food, do you have problems in that respect too, occasionally?
Yes, like just say occasionally at the intercoms, at the drive-through, I'd be trying to order something, and the person on the intercom would often start laughing, or I'd be stuttering, and they'd say, "I can't understand you. I'm sorry. Like, you know, it's kind of putting pressure on me to speak faster.
And this can only kind of make you feel slightly humiliated, maybe a little reduced, and certainly isn't going to help your confidence.
No, absolutely not.
How long has this been going on, Sandra? When did it begin, and how has it affected you as you've grown up?
So I first started to stutter at the age of about 3. It got progressively worse as I got older. I done speech therapy as a child, but that didn't really help me in anyway. It wasn't too bad in primary school, but when I started secondary school, the trouble started. I was constantly jeered at in the corridors, mocking how I spoke. In school, I was very academically bright. I was getting all straight A's, but I felt that I was kind of labelled as stupid and not intelligent.
Do you know what's quite interesting talking to you, Sandra, is that when we started off, because we didn't know each other, you were a little nervous, and I was a little nervous, and we were just kind of dancing around each other for a second to say hello. And the more we talk, the stammer, the further away the stammer goes.
Yeah, it is.
What's going on there? Should we call a psychologist and get them involved? Tell me, let's keep going, because your story will really resonate in so many cars and houses around the country today. You're brilliant. And things like making a hair appointment or ordering food. Will you talk to me about that?
Okay, so, like, it kind of depends on the day or the situation how bad I'll speak. But for example, often at times I'd be ringing up to say, like, a hairdresser or, like, for a takeaway, and I would often be stuttering on the phone and the phone line would just go dead. Like, so they would actually just hang up the phone instead of letting me finish speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of makes me, like, really, really angry and upset, you know.
Tell me about the dating game, Sandra.
The dating game. Okay, so I'm single now a good few years. Mm. I tried out online dating and I find the majority of the time, just say if I tell a guy online, I stutter.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the time, they actually stop talking to me. There was actually an incident. I'd been texting a guy for about 3 weeks, and I arranged to meet him in a pub here, and I walked in and reached out high, whatever, and he said to me, what drink would you like? And I was stuttering on Coke, and he said to me, well, he laughed and says, oh, Jesus, are you okay there? And I said, oh, like, I stutter. And he laughed and said, oh, you should have told me that when I was texting you. And I just then walked out. Like, so things like that have kind of shattered my confidence in, like, the dating scene, you know?
Would I be the first person to say to you, Sandra, as a matter of interest, that you wouldn't want a man like that in your life anyway if he's being such a...
Oh, yeah, I know. Like, but I think the problem is, like, that, like, stuttering isn't really spoke about often, like, so people aren't really educated about it, you know?
I don't think people take it as seriously as other things.
No.
Why do you think that is?
Like, I find, like, the kind of, like, the treatment, like, I have received in shops and restaurants, like, if a person, like, stuttering isn't classed as a disability, but, like, just say if a person with, say, Down syndrome was laughed at. You would be like told fairly quick, you can't do that. But like people seem to think that it's actually okay, like to treat a person with a stutter like they don't matter.
How do you feel about people? I do, of course I understand, because you're explaining it so clearly. That's why I understand. How do you feel How do you feel about people who, and I'd be guilty of this, I'm sure, so I'm not trying to be holier than thou, but how do you feel about people who jump in to try and finish the word you're trying to say, even though you're only halfway through a sentence? Like what?
Okay.
How do you deal with people like that?
That is actually the worst thing.
Is it really?
Anybody. Yeah, it's dreadful. Like, it actually makes you stutter worse.
Right.
If, say, like, a person finishes your word for you, or like it, and it makes you feel so stupid and so intimidated.
Right. This I did not know, but I'm glad you told me now, because I'm confirms my suspicion. What did you make of the story over in America, where at the Democratic convention they introduced a little fella called Braden Harrington, teenage boy who Joe Biden had met, and they'd had a lovely chat about Braden overcoming his stammer through a suggestion by Biden to read Yeats poetry. Had you seen all of that, Sandra?
I had, actually. I saw it actually online, and like, you know, it was great to see like a young little boy with a stutter being given such confidence, because for me, myself as a child, stuttering was never mentioned, you know.
And to see a boy at that level dealing with potentially the next president of America, but certainly a candidate, kind of raises the issue to, as you say, takes it out of the sort of, sure, what's wrong with you? And into the, now we need to understand and be a bit more patient and fair. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, yeah.
What's the story with you now? Where are you working, and how is it all going in terms of managing the stammer?
So I'm a clerical officer to the mental health service in the KSSE, and I work with the HSE the past 14 years.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of have to just kind of get on with it, you know what I mean?
You don't have much choice about it.
Do
you think people go, there's Sandra, she stutters, I'm not going to get into a conversation with her, and therefore I'm going to underestimate the fact that she's actually really bright, really interesting, very smart, great fun, and okay, it might take her 2.5 seconds more than you to say Coke for her vodka and her drink order, but underestimate her at your peril?
Yeah, like there is always like some people, like as I mentioned before, like, you know, in shops and stuff, but you know,
it's time for people like myself and everyone listening to the program to as you say at the end of your email, to make a difference in how people in everyday life treat people with stutters. Simple as that.
Yeah. Like, until you stutter, like, you actually don't know, like, the torture of being lost for words. You know, like, it's absolutely horrific. And, like, people just need, like, to understand, like, that it's not okay, like, to intimidate a person, his daughters. It's not okay, like, to laugh at them. It's not okay, like, to label them as stupid and not intelligent, you know?
It's very hard to come on the phone and talk to a creature like me on a radio show like this. You know, stammer or no stammer. And as I say goodbye to you, can I compliment you in a very non-patronising way? The fact that, as I said earlier, it started and I went, all right, here we go. Here's Sandra. And within
about, very nervous, right?
Yeah, like I said, so was I. I didn't know you.
Yeah.
And then within seconds, here we are. We're finishing. This was an amazing thing to do. So thank you for sharing your story. I mean,
Thank you so much.
No, it's brilliant. It's one thing to send an email, right? But it's quite another to come on and talk like that. So I appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you so much.
And I'll meet you in real life sometime when we're next in Newbridge in Kildare. How about that?
Oh, great. Thank you.
Sounds good. Okay. Thanks, Sandra. Mind yourself. Take it easy.
Thank you, Ryan.
All the best. Bye-bye.
See you.
Thank you. Bye. Sandra Kelly. I love her and I love her story and I love her honesty. She's joining us on the radio there from, as I say, Newbridge in the county of Kildare. The text number 51551. Professor Ivan Perry, a very good morning to you.
Hi.
Very nice. Good morning. Nice to talk to you this morning. You got in touch with us because of that remarkable woman we had on the show yesterday called Sandra, who talked about her stammer, but did it in a way that was pretty impressive, I would have thought. What struck you about her, if I may ask?
Yeah, sure. No, I think I was very moved by her interview. She was very clear, and she gave a very good account of her life and her experience as someone who stammers. And I was kind of saddened to hear that you know that she'd experienced rudeness and mocking from time to time, and I suppose it her interview highlighted, I suppose, some of the sort of intolerance and stigma that still surrounds stammering.
Mm. You know, you're a professor of public health at UCC. You're obviously a very busy man because everyone wants to talk to you. By the sounds of your phones this morning, they're hopping around you, Ivan. But what I was struck by, whatever about the individual conversation with Sandra, and I thoroughly enjoyed her company, I must say, in that chat, but was the relentless amount of messaging that came in after that conversation from people to say, I was mocked, I am slagged, I am taken, I am, to use the more modern use of the word, I am othered. By people, it seems like it's almost as if it's the kind of thing that people feel it's acceptable to be cruel about.
Yes, I mean that seems to be the case. I mean, I suppose I have to say that I haven't personally experienced that. You know, growing up as somebody who stammered, my own experience at home and in school is that, you know, people were pretty relaxed about it, but it is certainly the case, and I know many people who stammer who have experienced a significant amount of mockery and hardship, which is clearly unacceptable.
What's it like for you in terms of doing lecturing, giving interviews, and, you know, I don't know what age group you are, but was it harder before now, or has it got better with age, maybe?
Oh, it's got much, much better with age. I'm in my sort of early 60s now, and, it can still be challenging from time to time, lecturing or indeed doing interviews, or if I'm giving a talk at a major conference, I have to put in a lot more work in terms of preparation than if I didn't stammer, but overall it has become much easier as I've got older.
Do you believe that there's a sense of stigma, taboo, or do you think with conversations like this and the conversation yesterday that it's becoming less a problem in that regard?
I would hope it's becoming less a problem. I think part of the issue when people who stammer often have a huge sense of embarrassment and shame about their stammer, which in my view is unnecessary. But I suppose speech is very intimate. It's very personal. In speaking, we are trying to project a sense of our inner selves. And if you have a stammer, that can be very challenging from time to time.
What do you say, Ivan, to families listening in this morning with younger people among them who could be listening? Couldn't be any age group, frankly, but who are reluctant to kind of go out into public, to stand up in the classroom, to order around, to stop at the drive-by in the fast food place, because it's just not worth the grief. What do you say? Is it about persistence or what?
I think it's very, very important if you have a stammer or any disfluency to continuously expand your speaking comfort zone, and because if you don't, it can become restricted quite rapidly. So it is important, you know, to go to the shop and, you know, be prepared to stammer in public and quietly and with dignity insist that people wait and give you a moment to finish saying what you are saying. I suppose the other thing I'd say to families that particularly where there is where there are signs of disfluency in early childhood is that with appropriate referral and treatment, disfluency in early childhood can now be very well managed and managed in a way that prevents a lifelong stammer.
Do you find, Ivan, and it might be a personal question, do you find that your stammer is... it disappears when you're relaxed, if you're, you know, around the dinner table with people you love or in good company? Does it go up and down like that? It's like a spectrum almost in your own?
Yes, of course, because you see, speech is a fine motor action. And I use the analogy of getting in a good first serve in tennis.
Yeah.
And if you're, you know, there are some days playing tennis, you'll be relaxed. You'll be in the zone. Your game will go well. Other days, you'll be a little bit tired or a little bit anxious, and your game or your speech will go less well.
I hear you. Can I ask you off the beaten track, if you don't mind, Ivan, as you are, as I say, a professor of public health at UCC, and you survey the papers or the internet, whatever you're looking at this morning, having watched yesterday and events unfold, where do you think we are at the moment in terms of compliance and confusion or lack of?
Well, I suppose, you know, as you were saying at the outset of the programme, it's clear that Dublin is probably going to have to move into level three of the restrictions, given the numbers. And I suppose if you look back to the start of the pandemic, we have got many things right. We did flatten the curve. I think we have to be conscious always of the difficulties in making the decisions in the face of uncertainty, and while, you know, clearly some mistakes have been made and possibly are still being made. I'm a little bit concerned about maybe opening the wet pubs at a time that the third level students are coming back to university. But, you know, no one has all the answers here, and anyone who is dogmatically certain about what should be done next is probably not close to the fine-grained detail.
Yeah, what a excellently put, I have to say. Lovely clarity in that sentiment. Just a couple of messages briefly. Geraldine did the course with you. Remember, Ivan Perry is a very good lecturer on a very new course at UCC. And another says that Ivan Perry from Dr. Sarah Burke says, taught me public health and epidemiology. He was an inspirational teacher and is a gem of a person and is always worth hearing. So that's a good enough endorsement for us, Ivan. Thank you for your time this morning. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for that.
Pleasure. Professor Ivan Perry there, Professor of Public Health at UCC. All right, 51551, lots of texts coming in, but let's go straight to the UK and say a very good morning to our old friend Robert Harris. Good morning, Robert. Nice to have you on the show again.
Hi, Ryan. Nice to speak to you.
Okay, so where are you? Are you in the house, in the study, in the garden?
I'm in the study. Do I sound like I'm at the bottom of a mine shaft? I'm worried that I do.
It's not as beautiful as I would have hoped, but we'll if you keep nice and close to the microphone, I think is probably the key, and we'll see how we can survive.
That's, okay, sorry about this.
Not at all. You're in a bunker of sorts, so we'll forgive anything at this stage. And it's back to the bunkers we go. Will you give us the snapshot take on V2 for people who haven't read it yet?
Yes, it's a novel set at the end of November 1944, and it's about the German ballistic missile that they fired from the coast of occupied Holland at London. They fired 1,300 of these missiles, and it's about an engineer who helped devise the V2, who's working with the soldiers firing it on one side, and on the other side a British woman who is sent out to occupied Belgium to try and stop the attacks. And the chapters of the novel alternate between the two of them.
And not only that, but it was in my imagination, Robert, or did the chapters get shorter as the excitement builds to the end? I mean, is that something you do purposely, or?
I did, yes, I suppose, because the action got quicker, so you had to keep going back and forth. It's kind of like a action counteraction novel. So yes, as it speeds up, so the chapters get shorter.
Here's what I took from the book in many ways, Robert, as somebody who's never lived through a war, who's never served in uniform, whose only knowledge or interest in it has come from books, movies, and so on. What I got was the V2 as a rocket, as a weapon, was terrifying. And in fact, war is terrifying. And that expression kept coming back to me, the pity of war. It is horrible. And yet the movies, the books, the history lend it a sort of anti-glamour.
I think that that's true. I think probably it's particularly true about the V2, which was such a technically sophisticated, astonishing tribute to man's ingenuity in a way, and the sheer power of it. It flew to a height of 60 miles into low space and hit London 200 miles away within 5 minutes, traveled at 3,500 miles an hour. I mean, it was an awesome weapon. And there is part of you, as you write about it, that you can't help but sort of think, my God, what an achievement it was to build such a thing in 1944.
Mm. And I'm sure you allude to it as the book proceeds, and particularly at the end. Wouldn't it be beautiful if something so horrific could have been built for something much more beautiful?
Well, and of course, in fairness to the rocket engineers, who started out, and this is described in the novel, as a bunch of teenagers, idealistic teenagers, they really wanted to go to the moon and travel to the stars. But the only way that they could get the money to develop the rockets was through the government, and Hitler came to power in 1933. And immediately the German military were interested in the possibility of rockets as a weapon. So Wernher von Braun, who's a character in the book, he receives a massive amount of money from the Germans to develop the rocket. I don't think he ever lost his ultimate goal of putting a man on the moon, which, of course, in 1969 is what he did, the Saturn rocket that powered the Apollo moon program was based on the V2 technology.
Mm. So they were visionaries, but unfortunately got sidestepped by a madman.
Yes, well, it's the old joke by Mort Sahl. I aim at the stars, but occasionally I hit London. that was definitely true. It's also the case that Wernher von Braun sold the V2 to Hitler, that he flew to his headquarters after they made it work for the first time, showed him a film of it, and Hitler promptly ordered 10,000 of these rockets to be built to try and destroy London.
There's a kind of a really eerie moment that I think it's more than once it's described in the book, where they know it's kind of coming. They can feel it almost in the air. It's almost preternatural, and it's seconds that feel like time has gone into slow motion. Can you talk us through that, and how were you able to describe it so well?
Well, there are a few survivors' testimony about what it was like to be on the end of one of these things, and one thing that was quite common is that people said that just for a moment. It was as if all the air had been sucked away. Things went very still. And this was the rocket coming down at twice the speed of sound, compressing the air, pushing it out of the way. And then, you would hear the sonic boom as it broke the sound barrier, then the explosion as it blew up the building, and then the inrushing train-like noise of the rocket coming in. And so, it was a very weird sound. And because of the acoustics of London, this noise or this double bang would echo right across London, and maybe 7 or 8 times a day. If you can imagine the terror of that. And the ton of high explosive carried on the V2 would bury into the earth. And the force of the rocket coming in meant that the damage extended over a radius of about 1/4 mile. So although the V2 killed relatively few people, about 2,700 in London, which over 7 or 8 months is probably not that many, not as many as Hitler had hoped. It did huge damage and is said to have damaged about 600,000 buildings.
You've done something interesting as well in the book, Robert, among other things, which is to to bring women front and centre of the story. And in this case, Kay is our leading lady, if you want to call it that, based on, as you write in the notes, at the end, an obituary of a woman called Eileen Younghusband. And I suppose it's worth dwelling on that for a moment as to who they were. Were they kind of written, ghosted, if you like, by history for whatever reason? And why did you decide to go there? So there's 3 questions, I think, there, Robert, okay. but in your own time.
I can take it. The book came out of reading an obituary in the Times newspaper 4 years ago of Eileen Younghusband, who died at the age of 95, who was one of 8 women Air Force officers who were flown from London to Belgium, newly liberated Belgium, in November 1944. They were put into a bank vault for security. They were issued with slide rules, pencils and paper, and their job was to calculate the curve of the V2. Because it was a ballistic missile, it followed what's called a parabolic curve. Mm. So, and if you have a bit of data, i.e. the radar picked up its track soon after it was launched, and then you knew the point of impact in London, with those 2 bits of data given to these women in the bank vault, they could work out the curve back to the point where the rocket had been launched. And this was crucial. If they could do it in 6 minutes, the rockets were launched from mobile trailers. This meant that it took them about 40 minutes to disassemble the site, that the RAF could get a Spitfire over these woods in about 30 minutes, and they could try and hit them before they were able to get away. So it was a sort of race against time. This was mentioned in his obituary, and I thought that would make a brilliant story. And the notion of these women, they were billeted on local families. There were lots of German sympathisers still around in Mechelen. It was a winter, freezing dark. I just thought that this would be a great story about women making a vital contribution to the war. And you're right, they are. It's a very unknown story. Mm. I've always wanted to write a novel with a woman playing that kind of crucial role in it. And this seemed to offer me the opportunity.
It's certainly, it grabs the attention at the very beginning when she's in a bed with a man with whom she shouldn't be with, nor he with her. and down comes the V2, and you thought, okay, well, that kicks off things pretty quickly. we're in here, no messing. You were in, obviously, you were in lockdown writing at most, if not all, of this. So I was thinking of one of my favourite museums of them all in London, particularly, are the Churchill War Rooms. You know, it's stuffy and it's claustrophobic, but it reeks of history. Did you feel yourself bunkered down?
Yes, I did, really. I mean, normally what I do is write a novel between January and June. Mm. And I was going along merrily. I'd written about a quarter of it when suddenly the pandemic hit. And, it seemed rather irrelevant to be writing a novel, especially perhaps a novel about the V2. And my normal rate of progress slowed to about 100 words a day. And you remember how certainly people I knew that they found their sleep rather disturbed and dreams were vivid.
Yeah,
it was a difficult time to write, hard to concentrate. But after about 3 weeks, I thought, well, we're stuck with this. I mean, I'm at least going to try and come out at the end of it with a novel. And I think that the feeling of that time infects the book in a way, because there was a sort of wartime feel about it. There is still, in a way, that normal life has been upended. There is danger around. And we don't know how long it's going to take and how exactly we're going to come through it. And so I think, you know, that one senses how it might have been in the war a bit more now than one did before.
Were you watching the news last night or yesterday at all?
Probably through my fingers, yeah. Pressed to my eyes.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you. I was watching Boris Johnson last night. Now, it can't help the fact that you have to socially distance on the green leather benches of the Parliament. But he doesn't look like himself. Now, I don't know if that's post-COVID. I don't know if that's the Dominic Cummings Richelieu effect. And I don't know whether he just isn't able for what we would call in Ireland senior hurling. What's happening with this man?
Well, I mean, one should say to begin with that this is pretty grim for any leader to be faced with this situation.
Yeah.
And the pressure is relentless. Having said that, that's why they go in for it. They're supposed to be able to cope with it. And I just don't think it plays to his strengths. He's a naturally kind of upbeat and bullient character. And this is coming across as kind of snake oil salesmanship, really. And, you know, that you alluded to Churchill. I mean, Churchill's method in the war was to lay it on thick how bad things were. You know, this is going to be a long, hard struggle. I have nothing to offer you but blood, toil, tears and sweat. You know, he didn't try and sugarcoat it and say we're going to have a world-beating track and trace and all of this. And I think that he was quite seriously ill with it. And I don't think his personal circumstances, his divorce and so on, I think that's probably been pretty traumatic as well. I think he is in a bit of a bad place, to be frank.
Is he able for leadership at this level, at this time in your country's history and the world's history?
I think that he's a entertainer, really. Both as a columnist and appearing on television, have I got news for you and so on. That was his natural métier, and a figurehead, a man who comes around to cheer you all up and puts on funny hats and things. I mean, he's clever, but that was his shtick. And we're in a time when we need the very opposite of that, actually. The leaders that have done best, Angela Merkel, obviously, scientific background, slightly dull, but knows how to run a government. I think too much of the actual drive of the government and its strategy is devolved upon Dominic Cummings, his advisor.
Yeah.
And he's sort of unsackable, because if you took him away, he seems to be like the president's brain, in the words of a film in the 60s, you know?
Yes.
It's an unhappy state of affairs, to be absolutely honest, to add to all the other problems.
It always baffles me how Johnson is so mad about Churchill and comparing himself in the most unlikely manner to the wartime leader that we've been discussing. But I want to go back to a point you just made there, which was that Churchill was able to tell your people that this is bad. And Roosevelt, as we know, FDR said, with nothing to fear but fear itself, but also called on them and said, we need to rally because this is bad. You know, do leaders, particularly nowadays, I think sometimes they underestimate the intelligence sometimes of the electorate to take on bad news as long as they're led well.
I agree. And also there is a desire to come together and to get on with it together. And there was a huge wave of support and sympathy for Johnson to begin with, and which seems to be dissipating because you're getting tired of hearing the same old kind of optimistic rubbish, to put it more politely than I might do if we were in a pub.
Indeed.
And so, you know, the difference between Churchill and Johnson is day and night, really. I mean, Churchill, whatever his enemies thought of him, they all acknowledged he worked tremendously hard. He was an absolutely dominant figure, detail, and strategy and tactics, and a profoundly serious man beneath the kind of wit and jokey public image. One feels with Johnson there isn't a profoundly serious man beneath it, that he likes the trappings of it, likes being it, but he doesn't really relish the decision-making and the power. It's unfortunate, to put it mildly, that he's collided with this particular time. And we're not even talking about Brexit, are we?
So, no, we're not. Not this. I mean,
this is a storm-lashed island,
isn't it? Though I mean, to try and dismantle an international treaty, and so publicly, and so it beggars belief. You know, we are looking aghast at what's happening at the UK.
Yes, well, I think a lot of people here are too, and a lot of people. I was just happening to read before I started talking to you the Spectator magazine this week, which has a very long attack on their own former boss, own former editor.
Yes.
Where's Boris? You know.
Yes.
So it spread from people who were always sceptical about Boris, myself included, to the very people who were who were his closest supporters. There's just a sense of flopping around, really, and hubris.
Well, you know, a beautiful word, and not quite ancient Roman or Latin. But when you think of the Cicero trilogy, I would love to know what Cicero would think, watching what's happening in Washington D.C. and beyond, and talk about leadership and not telling the truth to the people, as we now know from the Woodward tapes. An extraordinary figurehead there. And again, a leadership deficit like no other.
Yeah, these were leaders elected in a completely different world. In his way, Johnson is a bit like Neville Chamberlain. You know, he was fine for one period, but he's wrong for this one. Whatever his qualities, you know, this isn't good. And the same with Trump. You know, they were elected partly to raise two fingers to the establishment, the elite. This is very like ancient Rome and Cicero, when the mob was whipped up against the Senate. It feels the same. And when something comes along like a pandemic or major international crisis, you find yourself with people who are anti-elite. They are, propagandists and populists, but they don't necessarily know how to run anything. And how to rally a whole country, not just, you know, whip up their own particular supporters. So, you know, it's a great misfortune for the British and the Americans that they found themselves with these particular leaders at this particular time.
Yeah, I think we're unfortunate that sometimes, politically speaking, to use the analogy, sometimes the dogs actually catch the car.
not with promising results. Either.
Correct. Robert, congratulations on V2. Obviously, look forward to meeting you in the flesh in due course. But in the meantime, thanks for giving us another joy of a read, and we wish you well. And we'll talk soon, I hope.
Thank you. Goodbye from the mine shaft.
Goodbye. Auf Wiedersehen.
The bunker.
Auf Wiedersehen. As Robert,
we'll meet again.
We sure will. I should have had Dame Vera's song ready to go there. We'll meet again is right. Robert Harris, always a joy. Gosh, I love talking to Robert. V2 is the book. I saw it in the bookshops yesterday, so it's shiny and new and ready for your delectation. So go grab it and enjoy.